Getting your money's worth compared to we think now, Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity are the names of the really great big exploring spacecraft we got on Mars. Getting a lot more for your money out of those things than you would with a human being. And the chances of getting the human being there and bringing him back home alive are so low. I don't think very many people are going to volunteer for that one. You could do a survey, Roy. How many people with the sound of our voice would volunteer to go to Mars? And particularly if you found out it's only a one-way trip to XC2GS, K2RIW.
I don't think we would get too many takers right here. I think it's the wrong type of age, and we kind of really like being alive. But, you know, some of these test pilots, that's another point. I don't know if you guys actually saw First Man, but we can maybe discuss that later on if you've seen it. Test pilots are a strange breed, and they take risks that I would never in my wildest imagination take. So my guess would be, especially among test pilots and such, you would find guys who would be willing to take bad odds just to get there, just to do that. Unfortunately, I don't think we'll have any takers here tonight, which is probably good for the general mental of our listeners out there. But again, there are guys who think in very strange ways that make no sense to me personally. So I think if you opened it up, I think definitely you would find test pilots and such, but you probably would find a lot of semi-suicidal people or don't really have the ability to kind of factor in risks and such who would jump at the chance.
There was a Newsday article a year or so ago about, was it Elon Musk, or one of the major guys was going to fund a spaceship to Mars, and they were looking for volunteers and some very intelligent students. Stony Brook, as I remember, was a nice lady from Stony Brook who volunteered to go as a one-way. My goodness, that is free thinking by my standards. And yes, the astronauts, they were a strange breed, most of them in the beginning were test pilots. And when I was listening to those private conversations on Apollo 16, and I heard Mattingly, Young, and Duke taking apart the instrument panel on the Apollo spacecraft on the way to the moon, taking apart the instrument panel because they didn't like the smell of the oxygen they were getting. And Houston found out what they're doing, and that it could create a short circuit and kill the whole damn spacecraft. In no uncertain words, they told them, please put it back together and leave it alone. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
That was Mars One, by the way. Let's not destroy Elon Musk.
Okay, but they did have some serious volunteers, and that amazed me. Didn't those volunteers amaze you, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, and they're still on the list. I don't trust that group. They don't have one piece of equipment. We have more equipment in our ham shacks than this guy's got to send somebody to Mars. I don't think he could send them on the Q-43 into the city. It's just I don't trust that whole group. But yeah, I was amazed. People signed up.
Well, basically, many people are foolhardy and glory hounds, and that suits those people. You know, the risks are semi-meaningless, I guess. I mean, you can never underestimate the foolishness of the average person out there.
It's amazing. It's good that our students in colleges and schools these days are thinking of the future. If we did a survey today of the kids in high school that are science-oriented and ask them, what are the chances that you believe mankind, somebody will be standing on the surface of Mars during your lifetime? I'll bet you 80% of them will say yes. And when you look at the details of survivability and cost, my goodness, not a chance, is my opinion. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, Dick, but you want young people to be idealistic because, you know, I mean, it's bad enough as we get older, we get a little jaded and we get a little less idealistic. So you got to start from someplace before you work your way into being a fully grown, sane, wise person. Okay, we'll move on to the next topic. Let's see. I offer the next item with a bit of a caution. A player who represents himself as a fool for a client, and that goes double for someone trying to be their own doctor. So that said, for 37.5 million adults who have trouble hearing without a hearing aid, Bose has a new product for you. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration recently approved audio technology company Bose to market a new hearing aid device. Dubbed the Bose Hearing Aid, it's designed to let people with audio impairments fit, program, and control the hearing aid without the help of assistance of a healthcare provider. The hearing aid uses air conduction to capture sound vibrations through the microphone. From there, the device processes the signal, amplifies it, and then plays it back through an earphone inside the ear canal through a mobile app that people can adjust the hearing aid with. Hearing loss is a significant public health issue, especially as individuals age, an FDA official said in a press release. And today's marketing authorization provides certain patients with access to a new hearing aid that provides them with direct control over the fit and functionality of the device. The FDA is committed to ensuring that individuals with hearing loss... Before approving the device marketing, the FDA says it received data from clinical trials of 125 patients. Those studies showed comparable results to those with professionally fitted devices. In addition, when participants self-fit the Bose... The FDA wrote in a blog post, Bose is not the first company to try this. The now-defunct startup Doppler Labs developed earbuds with active listening, enabling people to augment the way that they heard the world. There's also something called Neura, which unveiled earbuds earlier this year that are designed to boost hearing. What makes Bose different, however, is that FDA approval. Bose went through the FDA's de novo pre-market review process, which is a regulatory pathway for low to moderate risk devices that are especially novel and not readily available. Let me drop for a second. As the FDA mentioned, this is the first hearing aid authorized for marketing that enables people to fit and program their own hearing aids. Still, depending on state laws, people may be required to purchase the device through a licensed hearing aid dispenser. Now, it's not clear if this device, what this device looks like, or if Bose earphones, currently marketed as conversation-enhancing headphones, will simply be remarketed as this hearing aid. Now, the de novo grant by the FDA validates that Bose technologies can be applied to help people with mild to moderate hearing impairment, taking control of their hearing. We look forward to bringing affordable, accessible, and great-sounding solutions to the millions of people who would benefit from the hearing aids but don't use them. But guys, as always, caveat emptor. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2 Bravo Zulu with a comment.
Yes, Rich.
In terms of products sold to the elderly, attorney generals in every state have as number one complaints and investigations the hearing aid industry. And I just wondered why it's taken this long to have something like Bose be brought to market.
Now, let me see if I understand this correctly. What is the major difference between this Bose device and ordinary hearing aids that we buy? I guess the hearing aid that we buy, they tailor it the way they think is proper and plug it into your ear. Whereas this thing, I guess, is a box in front of you, and you got a bunch of knobs on that box where you can do the adjustment. Is that the major difference on the Bose, if I got it correct? Over to you, Roy.
Well, close to it. There isn't per se a box. What it is it's another one of those delightful little applications of smartphones. So you pull up your iPhone or your Android, you go to the app, and you adjust the equalization frequencies and amplitude and such, And the problem has always been how much an individual person should have a say in their health care. And that's why audiologists usually were the people who got the hearing aid, adjusted the hearing aid, and were the people in charge of the hearing aid, because they thought that consumers would screw it up, unfortunately. And of course, since you're paying a guy to do this, you're paying a guy to do this, so it costs more. So it's always been problematic to get it out of the hands of the audiologist. It's like getting eyeglasses out of the hands of optometrists. You can get eyeglasses through the web, but surprisingly, local opticians and such will not give you some of the numbers that you need to order a specific type of your glasses. So there's always that nonsense going on. Now, you could say that it's just a bunch of professionals who want to secure their income stream, or you could say that it's a bunch of professionals who think they know better than the customer. You know, who knows?
W-2-Tango-Tango-Tango. Go right ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, Dick, in New Jersey, I get my eyeglass prescription from my ophthalmologist or my optometrist, and I decide whether I want to get the glasses or not. Audiologist, same deal. You're right. Some states they will use local control to, you know, prevent you from going out on your own. So that the days of medical monopoly are breaking down. And if you live in a state where they won't give you your prescription in total, then you go to a different state or get an examination in another state. And in the meantime, you will beat up on your state legislators to fix it. And I think this is marvelous. The big difference in between the Bose product and everybody else's is FDA approval for self-administration and the breaking down of monopoly. And whether we like it or not, you can say that's a political decision that was made by the current administration to allow that to happen. It would never have happened under prior administrations of either political stripe. So this is, in my mind, this is a great thing.
It sounds like a great thing with reference to audio, and some of the things you were mentioning with reference to glasses. Maybe I'm lucky. My particular eye doctor, ophthalmologist or whatever, maybe I've got him properly programmed. I've learned enough of his vocabulary so I can tell the difference between the spherical correction, the cylindrical correction, the prismatic correction, the axis, and so on. I force him to allow me to grab the knobs on the machine that's mounted in front of my face so I can set the right amount of correction and the right angles. And when we come to a solution, because his eye chart is only 10 feet in front of me instead of 20 feet, and I want to really focus at infinity, I forced him to take the spherical measurement after we measure it and add another half a diopter to it so that I really focus at infinity. And when it comes to my bifocal, how much bifocal correction I want and whether or not my glasses are going to be made out of plastic or real glass, I managed to make all of those demands, and for me, they follow. Maybe I'm lucky. I don't know if you wear glasses, Roy, and if you're going through any of this. AC2GS, K2IW.
2 Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
One optician that I don't go to anymore, that after they did a complete exam, said, can I now have the prescription? And they said, that'd be $30. And I said, well, I just paid for the exam. All you have to do is print out a piece of paper. That'll be $30. The one I go to now gladly gives me a printout of the prescription.
Okay, Rich, but the secret is, do they include your pupillary distances as well as your diopter setting and angles of astigmatism correction?
22H.
They measure that and they include that. Everything I need to order glasses either from them or online, which I would say I do half and half. And they don't mind it at all.
Okay, very good, Rich. I recently had a set of glasses done, and they gave me my prescription, and when I asked for my PD, they said it's individual for each set of eyeglasses and not part of the optician, the optometrist's measurements, and that I would need to have them readjusted and remeasured for every eyeglass that I bought, so they wouldn't hand me my pupillary distance numbers. But I'm glad that you were able to get that. Lou, I hear you in the background. What do you have to say, Lou?
All right, ENY2H. Yes, I get the prescription, and I order online. And my understanding, at least last time I did it, was the law in New York State is they have to give you the prescription. They don't have to give you the PD, but I asked for the PD, and they've never said, well, it's dependent upon your glasses. They look at the center of my pupils, they measure the distance, and, you know, I have them write it on the prescription. But it is not they don't necessarily have to give you that. But everything else they do have to give you, from what I understand.
Yes, that's my understanding as well. And some of the nicer places give it to you, and the place that I went to had a perfectly rational, probably lying reason why. And as far as administrations, and I really don't want to touch politics with a 20-foot dipole, the de novo the Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act of 1997 set up the de novo classification. So I think you can't really point directly at this particular administration, since it kind of goes back to 1997. It took the FDA a few decades to figure things out, I guess.
Yeah, I have another comment.
Yes, Lou.
So, there's a lot of disruptors, you know. We know that we don't have buggy whip makers anymore. So as technology comes along and as the law may be amenable, things change. One area which I think is changing is the sleep studies if you have sleep apnea. Now, there's a whole deal. You got to go in overnight, and they titrate, you know, give you so much air or whatever, and they figure out, you know, what your settings should be on your CPAP machine. I believe the manufacturers are coming out with CPAP machines which do not require a sleep study. They're so automatic that they actually determine what the optimum setting is and adjust during the evening or whatever. So there's another industry that is going to be hurt. And, you know, again, how you look at it, but, you know, these sleep studies, that's pretty much a racket. Yeah, you got to get a prescription just to get the machine, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Medicare requires it, so on and so forth. That's just another area where we're seeing some change.
This is W2BZ, but how would Medicare or any insurance company then pay for it if they don't have a sleep study?
Well, I would imagine it's however the legal system wants to handle this, or however whoever's got the better lobby, but in just pure scientific terms, if the machine is, you know, if clinically proven that it's effective and it does what a sleep study would do for you, minus the sleep study, then I guess, you know, Medicare could accept it. But that, like Roy said, it's political, so they may not. But I don't think it's on scientific terms. I think it's more on, you know, lobbyist type thing.
Saying that the machine that you would get would produce reduced numbers that then you would submit to an insurance company or Medicare, and then they would reimburse you. I don't understand how Medicare would pay for a machine just because you say you want one.
Well, this is what I was told by suppliers in this industry, and that this is what's coming down the pike. I don't know that they have all of this in play at this point, but I guess if you're asking, is there a diagnosis of sleep apnea, and is this machine sufficient to do that? I mean, I suppose the machine could be programmed to say you have it or you don't have it. I mean, if the machine's not sensing that it has to help you in any fashion, then maybe they wouldn't pay for it. You know, maybe the machine itself is a certification. Maybe not. Maybe they'll just try to leave it the way it is as long as they can. But I think in pure, you know, technical terms, it may not be necessary anymore.
Just once again, I thought the sleep study, and I've had two of them, the purpose of the sleep study is to see how, you know, where you fall on the apnea scale and fall in a certain range, then you, or above, then, you know, then you qualify for Medicare paying for the machine. That's what I thought the sleep study was.
And right to age. Well, the sleep study, for example, it'll tell you, you know, you woke yourself up, you know, 17 times an hour or something like that. Well, envision that this machine may be able to give the same diagnostic. You're using the machine overnight, and, you know, this technically, I think we're sophisticated enough that you can envision a machine being able to do that without having to be certified by a human being. Maybe you can't, I don't know, but that's how I see it and how kind of it was explained to me. But again, I don't, you know, it hasn't happened yet, but this is what they're seeing around the corner, so there you go.
Well, as I see it, it's sort of a chicken and an egg sort of a problem, especially when it comes to billing, because once you use the machine, I don't know if you could just hand it back, and if it's initially a diagnostic machine that's free of any actual technician or physician or any professional, I think they're going to have a bit of a hurdle to get that done. I'm a little bit paranoid about sleep studies because pretty much every single person I have ever sent for one has had sleep problems. Either I'm a great diagnostician or it's rather easy to get an abnormal sleep study result. I have yet to kind of figure that out. But I think that the insuring companies and Medicaid and such are going to have a long, long chat with these people because they don't want to hand over, you know, a couple of billion dollars in equipment to them if they can help it.
Roy, there is a kind of a dental device that holds your jaw in a certain way and your teeth clamp down on it. The manufacturer of that claims that in many cases, correct sleep apnea and an elaborate approach of a CPAP machine may not be required. You have an opinion on that one, Roy. Go ahead.
1-2.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have much of any experience with that. I could sort of understand where repositioning the jaw and such would be helpful. My only question is how comfortable it would be through the night, but then I also would wonder exactly how comfortable it is really to have a CPAP machine going on all through the night as well. So that's a problem as well. But that's an interesting topic. I have to kind of look into that further.
Fortunately, again, as W2BZ, I have many years of experience with both. In fact, the dental appliance that I have is made of a hard material, which makes it very uncomfortable. The newer ones now, and mine's about 10, 12 years old, are a much softer material, and they do, you know, separate the jaw enough to open up, you know, the air passage, or I don't know the medical term. And it would be much preferred by me if I had the softer one than wearing a mask.
You sound like you're a happy user then of that dental product as long as it's the right soft material. Is that true?
Absolutely true. And now there are many free apps you could download that will measure your snoring, and you could play it back, and it's quite fascinating. So I am now testing my old dental appliance with the hard material. I just started a couple of days ago with these apps that are very accurate. Yeah, I would much prefer a comfortable dental appliance to an apnea machine with a mask, whether it's a full mask, a nose, or a pillow, whatever they call it, it's still very awkward.
Yes, I sort of wonder how kind of people deal with that type of machine going on in the background, and there's an entire industry, apparently. I'm sure everyone has seen the ads on television for CPAP sterilizing devices, so everyone's out there trying to make a profit.
Well, it actually, you know, with either device, the dental device or the CPAP machine, I do wake up much more refreshed than I do if I, you know, if I didn't use either one.
Oh, but that's the point of the exercise. It's interrupting your normal sleep cycle when you stop breathing. That's not conducive to any aspect of sleep, and so you get a more restful sleep and more curative sleep, if you will. So that's one of the points of the CPAP and the dental appliance, that it leads to feeling better and actually being healthier.
Absolutely, and supposedly, but you would know this, Dr. Roy, much better than I, that it's, you know, you could run into heart problems. You can die if you have severe sleep apnea. Just quick thing back to the hearing aids, there have been many companies that have been crowdfunded over the last 4 or 5 years to come up with a hearing aid, a much cheaper hearing aid than the $3,000 ripoff that elderly people pay. Unfortunately, pay. And I just wonder, how much is this Bose? Did they announce a price on it?
No, unfortunately, they haven't announced the model name, what it looks like, or how much they're planning to sell it. The big difference between this and the crowd-shared investment plans is that this one has the FDA approval so that you could buy it yourself without a audiologist and adjust it to your heart's content, whereas all these other devices probably lock you in still to an audiologist and visits and adjustments with him or her.
WS plan with the cost?
Yes, Paul. Well, as I said, unless you know better, they didn't announce the price. They didn't announce what it looks like. It might be a repackaged version of a consumer product that they're already selling. But Bose has been rather quiet about the specifics. They just are happy with the FDA approval.
Another website. I looked at it earlier today, and it was below $1,000. That's what they're shooting for. So that's going to dramatically change things. The average, they said, is between $2,000 and $6,000, and that number will drop. You know, they also said it was, for people with medium to moderate hearing problems. The severe ones are still going to have to most likely stick with the audiologist. You know, you go in, they hook you up to this thing. When you're listening, they could see on the computer what frequencies you're missing. And if you're severe, they will set that thing up where they won't even put that in, because you're not going to hear it at all anyway. So they'll just concentrate on the frequencies that you can hear. So with a good audiologist, they say you're going to be better off with them. But the article did say if you're medium to moderate, you could probably get a pair for $1,000 or less. Back to you, Roy.
I've got a quick question for Lou. Lou, you've used that dental device. How does it work? I am guessing it holds your lower jaw out more forward. Is that what's going on? W-Y-2-U, K-2-I, Y-2-H, K-2-I-W?
All right, that happened. I just used it. The other fella used it. I just used a CPAP machine. I use it with the nose, the little nasal nares. So it's very comfortable for me. I've been on it probably 20, 25 years. So I love it. Doesn't bother me at all. But I think the other fellow has both. He has the dental client, so why don't he pick it up? I'm sorry I don't have your name, but over to you.
Yeah, I've got him mixed up. Rick, W2BZ, I think it is. Does the dental device hold your jaw more forward? Is that approximately how it works? Over to you, Rick.
That's exactly how it works. It holds your lower jaw forward. And the dentist that made this for me, he was the one to adjust far forward. Your lower jaw would be pushed.
Sounds to me like it's simple and does the job rather well. And having a mask over my face would make me feel uncomfortable. I presume your jaw doesn't develop any pain or any other disadvantage from using that device. Back to you, Rich.
Again, I have the old style, the hard one, and it does a little bit. I've been trying to get back into it, wearing it a little bit each night, and I could only wear it for, let's say, an hour at a time. But again, the new ones are soft, and that's why you need somebody, you know, a dentist who does this, specializes in this, you know, to adjust it. You have to go back maybe a couple of times, and he'll get the right, you know, the right protrusion for you. But what the other gentleman said, I didn't get his name, but I have a friend who also swears by the machine. He will not, he has a portable one for when he travels and a home one, and he will not go to sleep without it, and this has been for 15 years now.
If the one that's soft is more comfortable to your teeth and your mouth, what makes you not use the soft one, Rich? Is that because you don't own a soft one yet?
Yeah, that's correct. I don't own a soft one because I started using the CPAP machine, and I've just been lazy about it, non-compliant, which is not good. And my CPAP machine has now malfunctioned. And it's funny this whole subject is up because I have to, right on my calendar this week, I have to bring the CPAP machine back to where I got it at Priya Healthcare and get it fixed or get a new one. But yes, I just haven't gone to back to the dentist. He was in a horrible accident in Italy, a skiing accident, and so I haven't talked to him in like 5-6 years.
That CPAP machine now, Rich, does it have a fail-safe mechanism to it? If the mechanism fails, is there any way it can restrict your airflow into your body?
Not that I know of it. It's a good question, but I did a lot of research into this and never once came across, you know, a cautionary question like that. So I guess maybe the other gentleman can answer that who's been using it 20 years.
Lou, you might have an opinion on that.
All right, so let's say the power goes out. You're going to know right away because, you know, you're not going to, you're going to have this thing on your nose or whatever, you know, and it's just like having a cold. Your nose is going to feel like it's blocked or whatever, so you know. You're going to wake up. They do have, there's a port very near where your nose is, for exhaling, because obviously they don't want you to retake the carbon dioxide you just breathed out. So having a little port there for escape of the air, you know, make sure that the hose is always filled with oxygenated, you know, room air rather than your exhalation. So, you know, that's important. But that's how they... that's how they're made, that little coupling. But I love it. In fact, when we went to Dayton this year, you know, Matt Harris and I, we were in his van. We camped for, you know, those few days and nights, and I used it in his van. You know, it works on 12 volts also, and it was fine. So, NY2H.
Thank you for all that information. You got it right.
You put in, and do you have a heated hose or a non-heated hose?
I have a non-heated hose, and I elected not even to get a humidifier. I tried the humidifier once, and I felt like I was going to drown. And I never have a problem with dryness or anything, so you know, I'm just happy with the configuration I have. So I don't worry about heated hose or humidification.
I thought. I guess you, so you have the same machine, you're using the same machine that you started off with 20 years ago?
Negative. I got a couple of machines. I got a couple stored away that I had in the past. And this one's a Remstar, I don't know, it's probably about 2-3 years old. I had a couple of sleep studies. I went to different, you know, had to get recertified. Yeah, there's a lot of, like you say, there's a lot of red tape. And even with the suppliers, I found a better supplier than the stock that was using. You know, I could go on, but it's, you know, it's just a lot of red tape. But no, the machine I have now is a couple of years old. So I've gone through a few of them. I took on a plane, and I didn't know better. I had it in my luggage, and that thing cracked when I opened the luggage. So if I go on a flight now, I take it carry-on.
And Roy would know better than I, certainly, but that distilled water is a must, and you don't put regular tap water in there if you are using a humidified machine, whether you have a heated tube or not. Is that true, Roy, that it would be dangerous just breathing in mystified tap water?
It's probably far safer to go with distilled water. You don't want to introduce, because different people have different mineral contents, and so, you know, why complicate matters? And always, you know, try and sterilize all these things, because still water can grow all kinds of interesting things that you really don't want to breathe in as well. So cleanliness is very important with these devices.
Let me get a feeling for the percentages here, Roy. Among senior citizens, are 25% of them using a CPAP from your point of view? Over to you, Roy.
Well, unfortunately, I haven't seen any good hard statistics on that. I would tend to think that was a little bit on the high side. I would tend to think that it would be more like 10, but then, again, this is just a gut feeling. Not based on any kind of literature that I've read recently in the last few years on the subject.
That's what I want to know. That's a data point, and I've got to use it accordingly.
I had much worse apnea at 195 pounds than I do now at 170 pounds. So that's a big factor also. And I would advise everybody, to download one of these apps, and there are new ones that are just absolutely great, and record yourself for a few nights. You might be either pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised.
Okay, very good, Rich. By the way, Google is your friend. I Googled it, and sure enough, the sleep apnea information for clinician site listed as 80% of the entire United States population. You got to take that, I think, with a small grain of salt, perhaps, but they speak of 22 million Americans suffering from sleep apnea. And my guess is what's causing a majority of these things, as Rich suggested, is the general obesity of the United States citizen. It's really not healthy for us. It speeds heart disease. It speeds diabetes. It speeds arthritis. It really prematurely ages you, and it sometimes blocks your breathing while you sleep. So you guys who way more than they should, really consider your lifestyle. Don't go on a diet to lose X number of pounds. Don't go on some really weird diet you can only maintain for a short period of time. Change your habits for a lifetime, and that's the healthiest way of losing and maintaining a proper weight.
I've got a guess on this one, Roy. When a person sleeps on their back, I think sleep apnea is easy to happen. If they sleep on their side, I think it's less likely. Am I wrong on that one? Over to you, Roy.
Yes, I've heard sort of the same thing, and it's partially the anatomy. The head goes back, and that causes the obstruction to be more severe. So in postures where the head is moved off to the side and doesn't have a chance to roll back, you have a little bit less problems. But again, everyone's a different person. There are some people who could lie on the side or on their stomach and still have problems breathing.
Roy, may I ask you one more hearing aid question?
Sure, I'm not an otolaryngologist or an audiologist, but feel free.
Now, my hearing's going downhill, and it's usually the high frequency. And I read recently where if you want to make a person who has a hard time hearing you hear you better, don't talk louder, talk lower, for, you know, an elderly person. But I learned from a friend of mine, because he just bought a $6,000 pair of hearing aids, that actually what's amplified is the noise behind you, not in front of you. Is that true?
Not to my understanding. Again, this is why it's important theoretically for an audiologist to adjust the frequency and the amplitude so that you're not amplifying the noise more than necessary to offset the loss of frequency sound. And it's very, very common for people, as we all get older, we lose more and more of our high frequency range. About 3-4 months ago, I did a little audio illusion with either Yanni or Lonnie, and everyone heard the one that you hear if your high frequency range isn't as great as it should be, except for me. I can hear about 10,000 hertz, and as we get older, it gets worse and worse and worse. So I'm not quite sure if it's a definitive thing about the hearing aid and the noise. I think it has to do more with adjustments, reflections, and other aspects of audiology.
But what he was saying is that all hearing aids really amplify noise behind you rather than in front of you. It's not an adjustment, you know, like a fader adjustment, you know, back and forward. It's just back, and I couldn't understand why that would be.
Yeah, that basically makes no sense to me whatsoever, because I'm thinking in terms of what acoustical pickup device has, some have directionality, there's cardioid, there's all different kinds of patterns. But there's no way that you can focus a microphone, as far as I know, I mean, maybe the guys out there know better than I, that you can focus it in length. I mean, it would be sort of interesting to be able to do that. And you can do phase relationships with your brain, and that's sort of how you hear people at cocktail parties, and you can kind of piece together the conversation of someone in a crowd with a whole bunch of other people. But that's a different thing than just distance calculation. So I'm very suspicious of that explanation. But if anyone has any more information, I'd love to hear about it.
Jerk.
Yes, Eric.
If anybody is wearing a hearing aid, it wasn't a distance calculation. It's actually the hole in the hearing aid where the sound is coming through is pointing backwards, not forward. And I said to him, but you want to hear the person you're talking to, and usually that person is in front of you. He goes, no, it's back. It's in, you know, you hear better behind you. And I didn't understand it, but, you know, the guy's a lawyer and a judge, and I don't think he was putting me off.
Okay, I would feel more comfy if he was an audiologist or an otolaryngologist, but I believe Eric wanted to say something.
I do. Happens to be a subject I'm quite aware of. A couple of things I want to point out. When you do go to an audiologist and you pay the $6,000 or the ridiculous amounts of money for the hearing aid, you're buying a couple of things that I'm not sure of this new device that you're talking about includes. But what I want to point out is that hearing aid technology has gone light years from what it used to be, say, even 10 years ago. The traditional hearing aid in the olden days was you wear it over the ear and the mic points out straight in front of you. And there's a lot of disadvantages to that, because basically you had a very simple equalizer inside that thing and a gain control. Today, they make hearing aid devices with DSPs in them, and some interesting ways of manipulating it. I'm going to let it drop for a second. In terms of being able to determine that your hearing has a certain kind of a spatial reaction that works in with your brain at the same time, and the total in-ear devices, not only do they block out the external sounds, so that way you don't get any phasing effects from it, but it's actually in the central locus point in which the sound enters the ear, and the phase relationships are maintained on the way through. The nice part about the DST stuff is that, let's say you've got a little hole at, say, 6K, and then it comes back at 7K, you can actually fill that hole and make the actual hearing flat, and also keep the phase components exactly where they belong. And that's the kind of technology that hasn't existed in not too far distant past. So there is a plus to going to an audiologist, or at least a good one that knows what they're up to. KC2GS,
okay, thanks a lot, Eric. But do you kind of understand the point about... I thought at first the thing was that somehow the hearing aid picked up the noise behind the source of the sound, but now I get the idea from Rich. It's listening to reflections off the reverse, off your back. Do you know exactly what kind of pattern the average modern hearing aid actually has? I mean, just like regular microphones have cardioids, are there any specific shapes of directionality for hearing aids?
Absolutely. You go back to the old days, think of it as a small electric mic that's actually mounted in the case with little tubes that point straight out, and that's forward facing. They're typically what they call one-sided cardioid. Basically, it looks forward, and it doesn't see too much to the sides. The inner ear stuff, you actually can design its characteristics in terms of what it's listening to, because it's actually at the focal point of where the sound is entering the ear canal. So whatever your ear as the reflector is doing with the in the ear point type of device, you're actually getting the reflector that's capturing and focusing the sound is your ear, so those characteristics stay the same.
Okay, very good. I mean, that's the auricle. The ear has auricle with the folds in our ears that shape the sound entry into the ear canal. So basically, I get the sense that you don't quite know what Rich's friend, the lawyer judge, it means when he's talking about how the noise is picked up at some other place other than some guy talking in front of their face.
Well, think of it as a shotgun microphone in a typical olden day hearing aid, or even modern cheap ones. So if there happens to be a hard surface behind the guy who's talking, it's acting as a reflector of whatever is happening behind him.
Okay, but that's a kind of a secondary pattern, though. Isn't the primary pattern straight and directional, right?
Absolutely. If you've ever seen a Plantronics headset, think of it as something like that. But it's really a narrow pointed beam in terms of the area that it's picking up. And the concept is to try and keep the noises to the side out of it. The person who's wearing it, you're generally interacting with what's in front of you, not what's on the side or what's behind you.
Eric, in the broadcast industry, a wireless mic that their personality on screen always is wearing seems to do a beautiful job. It's located on the person's lapel of their, or on the guy's tie, for instance, or on the girl's blouse. What kind of an antenna pattern, audio antenna pattern, does that have? And that antenna pattern, why wouldn't that be good for a hearing aid? KE2JEJ, K2RIW.
WK2J. Actually, the pattern between what we use in a lapel mic, think of it as if you've got a balloon, and the balloon is the neck of the balloon is where the microphone is, and as you go up the balloon, that's the pattern in terms of what's being captured. The hearing aid microphone is very similar. Actually, they're both electric. They're basically capacitive microphones based on a piece of mylar film that's stretched across an aperture. So the characteristics of them are pretty much the same. It's the baffling of the microphone structure that makes the pattern different, either wider or narrower. K2RIW, K2J.
In W2BZ in the movie business and the, let's say, TV series business as opposed to the news business, and in opera and wherever sound is, you know, absolutely critical, it's my understanding, Eric, that they try to put the mic above, like in the hair above the person rather than below.
So, they also use different types of microphones, but they also can use the same. When you're an announcer and you're doing a bunch of headsets on TV, the microphone is an expected accessory. I think it was Perry Como that introduced the microphone to the television audience and made it part of a TV show. So there's a difference. When you're doing a theatrical production, you know, if you're seeing a musical, many of the productions, you'll see them wearing this thin little thing that comes around the front of their face to the edge of their mouth. And that's basically a little tube that goes to an electric that's usually up in their hair, so you can't see it. There are lots of different tricks, but in a dramatic or a theatrical production, the whole concept of miking is completely different.
In my experience, if it has to be remote, you know, wireless in the first place, that they do try as best they can to put it in the hair, you know, right above the forehead, you know, in theatrical films and stuff like that.
Well, in a theatrical production, you don't want anything that detracts from what's being displayed. And, you know, you might be doing something that's an old Italian opera, and you don't want any modern technology peeking out in there. But you still may be, you know, singing to an audience of, you know, 20,000 people, so you've got to get that voice out there. But again, two different environments, two different things. Television and the lapels that we put on the tie are kind of expected.
And the double mics are for sale safe, right?
Well, if you're a big network that gets paid for every penny of time that you put somebody's product on the air, yeah, you're going to double and triple yourself. If you're a beg for me station like we are, we don't go that far. If something happens, something happens. You'll see the stage guy bring another microphone out.
Eric, why do the TED Talks always have this microphone that's a thin piece of tubing in front of their face that goes back to the ear and the rest of the network, whereas broadcast people don't use that? Why do those two industries use different kinds of mics? Over to you, Eric.
Well, again, it's different environments. You're going to be standing up there giving a lecture for half an hour. You're generally standing in front of a large audience, probably in a theater. You don't want to risk the problems of feedback and a few other things that can happen. You're basically wearing a wireless mic pack and a microphone that you don't have to touch. It's permanently planted and just in the right place, and it doesn't pick up any crap.
But the broadcast personality has a very similar problem. He's in a non-feedback audio system, and that mic on his lapel does such a beautiful job. If a TED person wore the broadcast microphone, wouldn't that work?
All right, there's some more problems you're not thinking about. When you put a microphone on a person and it's on a piece of cloth and you're moving around, you start to hear these little ruffling noises. That's one of the issues, whereas the suspended microphone doesn't have the vibration problems and the little noises that happen. When you're doing a television show, you're probably not playing to audiences of thousands. Plus the fact, Most studios are set up in such a way where the PA audio really doesn't bounce forward into the action area of the stage. That's another plus. There's a couple more things. When you're doing not a talk show or sitting down kind of thing, when you're doing a moving type of production, you may have a microphone overhead that's following the people that has a very directional pattern, so that you don't get any of the mixing. Just different environment, different situation, different equipment.
That Boone microphone overhead strikes me as being so disadvantaged. Is that ever used anymore?
In you know, location work, even in on set, in the film business and the TV business. But in the news business, you know, that can't be done. So, and in the news business, you know, you're on a very, very quiet set and a lot less is going on. But miking from above, you know, sound rises, I think, much more efficiently than it drops.
Still used a lot. All you got to do is watch the little intermission pieces on Saturday Night Live and you'll see somebody moving a boom mic out of the way.
That's the nightmare of every boom operator, is dipping the mic into the frame and hearing the director yell cut when you have Tom Hanks on the set with, I don't know, Amy, what's her name? You know, at $10,000 an hour in count.
Dick.
Okay, thank you. I've gotten most of my answers. Audio is complicated, Roy. Audio and visual. There's a lot more complication than first meets the eye. Pun there somewhere.
Yes, I agree, Dick. And in addition, I noticed that the news readers and such, they also have that little earpiece in their ear, which seems to be just basically hollow plastic that feeds a transducer hidden somewhere else. Those things pop out all the time when I'm watching cable news.
First thing they call IFP. The actual transducer is on the back of his shirt cuff, you know, around the center of the back of the neck, a little clip. And it's this little plastic tube that's coiled that goes into an earplug. And that, when you see the guy talking to someone on the satellite, he's hearing the audio from the satellite, or the director tells him that there's breaking news coming up. You know, it's a way for the talent to know what's going on or to take instructions of what has to happen next, or hearing the other side of the conversation.
The fact that thing keeps popping out of the guy's ear, is that because the technician installing it didn't spend enough time putting in the right one?
Well, generally on-air talent carry their own, because you don't want to be mixing your earwax with somebody else. The really professional guys actually get an ear mold made, and once you lock your ear mold in, all the tension you want on it isn't going to pop out, but not too many people do that. That's kind of the best way. It also allows them to hear themselves talking just as though one side of your head is muted. And there's pluses and minuses to it. That's why some people like the feathered little plug. They look like a swimming earplug, which actually has a tube going into the center of it. It goes back to the transducer in the back. The transducer looks like, if you remember when you got your first little crystal radio set and it had a little bulb on the end of it and the two little wires of that round thing that came out, that's exactly what it looks like.
Occasionally the talent will yank the thing out of his ear. Is that because he doesn't like what the director is saying to him? That's question number one. And question number two, these IFBs, did anybody ever install one of those in a stereo manner? Over to you, Eric.
Okay, you asked an interesting question. Yes, there is a stereo version of the IFB, for especially in wireless applications. It's typically used during rock concerts and things of that nature. In the broadcast studio, IFBs actually generally are connected to the master intercom panel, which actually brings a flexibility of putting multiple sources into it. There's more than one reason why the guy may yank it out of his ear. The first thing that we'll do is that when I'm running the repeaters through IRLP and you're listening to them, you want to rip your headphones off because you're hearing your voice delayed. That's usually the number one reason they're pulling it out of their ear.